Oprah Show on a busy Saturday morning. We have so much to talk about with the news late last week that the FBI, despite all of the mistakes they made in the Trump-Russian collusion hoax issue, which, of course, the Durham report exposed, and alleged reforms made in the FBI, over 275,000 inappropriate searches under the guise of the FISA Act exposed by the inspector who did that audit for the FISA courts. Absolutely reprehensible behavior. We'll unpack that a bit. The woke wars continue as Riley Gaines testifies in Congress that a Will Thomas, who likes to be called Leah Thomas because he wants to dress up like a woman and swim against the women, walked into the girls' room, the ladies' dressing room. Quite compelling testimony. Target now targeting our children for grooming them for transgender. And not only acceptance, but of course, celebration and, yes, advocacy. We have tons of stories. Oh, we have arrogant congressmen on tap. I'm going to play that for you in just a minute. And, of course, want to know whether our producer today, Anton, the big question for Anton is, if Adidas were to come to you, and because I know you're a fashion guy. You're a fashion guy, Anton. You're in for Leah today, and I'm glad you're here. Thanks for being here. The big question for you is, if they ask you to model a one-piece woman's swimsuit, would you do it?
I don't think I have the legs for it. I would have to politely pass. My legs are a bit hairy, so I don't think I would pull that off successfully.
Well, there's so many. We're going to be talking with Andrea Mew at 6:25. She's with Independent Women's Forum, and in a discussion I had with her last evening on my weekend show, and I really wanted you to hear it because it's a passionate plea for a return to some kind of sense and traditional definition and recognition of the biologic sexuality and gender distinctions that accrue to men and women. We're going to play that for you at 6:25. I had a conversation with Cindy O'Loughlin, who is, of course, the Senate Majority Leader, the floor leader, I should say, in Missouri. And she's taken some hits from, people, I think she and Caleb Rowden, the leaders in the Senate, taken some hits from those that of the former conservative caucus. We talked with Nick Schroer last week, great friend of mine. Senator O'Loughlin is a great friend of mine. I've talked with Bill Eigel, who's a good friend of mine. Senator O'Loughlin was my former senator, and Caleb Rowden is my current senator in my home residence. But, of course, I'm very fond of Nick and Bill as well, and I just wonder if they could all get along. And I asked Cindy about that. We'll talk with her about that at 7 o'clock. Larry Behrens, who's our Power for the Future guy, is concerned, as am I, about continuing assault on our energy independence, on our financial security and economic stability in this country, both collectively as a country and as individuals. You know what I mean. They're coming for your gas stoves. They're coming for your dishwasher, your regular clothes washer and dryer. And we'll talk with Larry about that. Virginia Cruda, of course, joins us at 7:45 for our regular get together with her. And we'll talk a little dentistry with Dr. Dan Cusimano, who is trying to revolutionize it's a back to the future movement. Let's just put it that way, at Advanced Dentistry of St. Charles, which he has now been running for a year. And I want to talk to him about some dental innovations, as well as financial dental innovations, if you're struggling to think about how to pay for the dental work. He's got some great ideas there. And then, at 8:25, we're going to wrap it up with an expert who's done a documentary on Michelle Obama and thinks like I do that Michelle may have a run in 24. That'll be very interesting. So a big show all morning. The number 314-912-1019 if you want to join in on the program. Anton will answer the call, and then we'll get you on the air if at all feasibly possible. Tim Scott filed for presidency Thursday or Friday, formally, after he'd announced that he was going to run a week or so earlier. I think his entry into the 24 GOP presidential primary is a pivotal and an important move. I don't know of any more articulate spokesperson for the American ideal than Tim Scott. the guy. I mean, of course, Clarence Thomas is not a political person in that sense, having him run for office, but he would be another one. The stories that these men tell, rising from, you know, the ravages of or directly, you know, victims of the Jim Crow era or their, you know, immediate preceding generation to great positions of respect, authority, and properly limited and wielded power, which is so important. And I'm just, I'm thankful his voice is going to be there. And he's someone to keep an eye on because I love the way he speaks about America. I love the way he speaks about the American dream that he has lived and the American values that are gradually, well, not gradually, they're rapidly eroding before our eyes. We look forward to that. Let's get right at it. There's a stark contrast between the likes of a Tim Scott, people who want to, who advocate, and others who are currently in office as well, who advocate limited government and who don't, at least as best I can tell, like to wear their authority and their position of power on their sleeve. They're always checked by their humility of their backgrounds. My favorite politicians are. That's one reason I have a problem with Donald Trump. I've told you that. He doesn't have that humility and that self-awareness that it's not, you know, it's always good when you're in a place of power and success and so forth. It's good to recognize that, you know, you don't, it's not all about you that got you there. You know, it never is, never is. And I think when people get power, you know, it can corrupt. We know that old song, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. That saying is so important. Well, the other day I caught a, what a reprehensible congressperson this is. What a reprehensible human being this is. This is Daniel Goleman at a, this was a hearing on Antifa, on domestic terrorism. And this representative, Daniel Goleman, went after a journalist who is one of the new journalists. He's a writer for Town Hall. You may have seen him on Fox or other outlets. Julio Rosas is his name. He's one of these guys that gets in there with his cell phone. And I mean, he does boots on the ground, get at the belly of the beast journalism. I mean, he is there in the action. Like you see these foreign correspondents right in the middle, you know, they're embedded with a platoon that's fighting the Russians or the Afghanis or whatever. And you got to honor these guys that are getting in it. They're not sitting in a glass tower at New York, you know, in New York City, in the New York Times office trying to report remotely. They're in there. And so Rosas was testifying, and this is what Daniel Goleman, this is clip one, Anton. This is what Daniel Goleman said to him, and listen to what he said in the way he spoke about this young reporter.
Get us, gaslight us up here as if Antifa, which Mr. Rosas, apparently the expert now in organized terrorist activity, has overruled the FBI director, who says, there's a headline, says Antifa is an ideology, not an organization. No, no, no. Let's not listen to the FBI director. Let's listen to, sorry, what's your title? Senior writer at Town Hall, who is going to tell us that the FBI director is wrong. And I'd like to introduce, there's no question.
Now, there's so much wrong with that clip. He, first of all, the way he's, you're a writer for Town Hall. Oh, excuse me. Don't waste my time. Let them eat cake. I mean, what these congressmen and these senators, first of all, they have to realize that the optics of them sitting up at a higher level, just a physically higher level than the people that testify. You can argue, well, that's so that I can see them and they can see me, which is a crock. That's absolutely a crock. They're already at a physical advantage in terms of just the optics of power and authority. And yes, they deserve respect. Don't get me wrong. They do deserve respect. On the other hand, they're already in a position of advantage. And then to speak so condescendingly, so dismissively of a guy that has been in the middle of these things where these these lily-livered, sniveling miscreants, these Antifas, who wear the masks because they're cowards. They don't want to be seen. Oh, God forbid I'm identified while I'm beating some innocent person up there on the street who happens to disagree with my anarchist ideology. Anyway, Julio Rosas, he's reporting on these things. He's done some great reporting because he's been right there and has seen it, eyewitness style. Well, Julio Rosas fought back, and we the people are fighting back on this level, on the woke level, on the transgender level. We are fighting back. And listen to what Julio Rosas said, clip two.
Thing that one of my colleagues said about you a little while ago. I'd like to give you time to go ahead and do that.
Yeah, thank you, Congressman. Well, I think it's funny to be lectured by an heir to the Levi Strauss Corporation. And that, honestly, that's probably why he doesn't consider property damage to be that big of a deal, because not only does he have that, but he also has what some would describe an impossibly good stock portfolio. But what I can tell you is that in these riots that happened 3 years ago,
and he goes on and talks about when he was there, he saw the destruction that went on in small businesses, not to mention the crimes against people. I mean, you saw it. That reporter, who is that? That Asian guy. You know, he does a lot of that reporting, and he got beat up. Remember, he got beat up by Antifa up there in the Northwest. It was at Portland or Seattle. You know, these reporters are putting themselves in harm's way to get the story out. And by the way, when Daniel Goleman, the representative, said, well, who's this reporter to counter what the FBI director says, that this is an ideology, it's not an ideology when someone in a black mask and black, hoodie and everything, they wear uniforms. They're basically a militia. They're an anarchist militia that don't want to be seen. They're cowards. I don't call it an ideology when they torch a place or they jump on and vandalize someone's car or beat up someone. I don't think that's ideology when someone fist impacts your face. That's not ideology. That's called a crime. That's called an assault. And I thought Julio Rosas, by the way, points out Goldman, in case you didn't know, he's estimated to be worth over $250 million because his great-grandfather, I think on his father's side, was a chairman of the board of Levi Strauss. Wow. So you sit up there high and mighty, you're a congressman, and you're going to tell some little guy who's down there and putting himself in harm's way to report on what's really going on with the anarchists that were causing all of the mayhem during those riots. And you're going to demean this guy with all of your wealth and power and stance. Shame on you, Daniel Goleman. We the people are going to fight back. And I hope it doesn't come. I pray to God that it doesn't come as this country moves towards oligarchy and towards, you know, the socialists who have and all the rest of us. You know, under socialism, those socialists, they always come out really good. The rest of the people, we get treated like that, not only in terms of just uncivil behavior by the bosses, the leaders, the political power mongers. But then they start controlling with their corporate buddies all of the economic purse strings. And the rest of us, let them eat cake. No, worse, let us eat the crumbs that came off the cake. All right, enough of that. And now, on to the woke destroying, which is, of course, what we do here on Saturday mornings. And that is to point out the travesty that is the insanity of the transgender movement on our children. And my favorite group of conservative/independent women is the Independent Women's Forum. And we had a chance to get together with Andrea Mew and talk with her about her piece in The Federalist. Have you shopped at Target lately? Wait till she tells you about that when we come right back on The Randy Tobler Show, along with Anton. Glad you're here with us this morning. Here,
Leah Thomas, a biological male swimmer for the University of Pennsylvania. And let's be very clear. If you have eyes, Leah Thomas is in fact a dude. That's just simple, obvious truth. Everybody knows it. Literally everybody knows it to be true.
That's Representative Chip Roy, calling it what it is. And more people are pushing back against the hysteria, the insanity that is the trans movement. And it's just taking over America. But I think there is one great group called Independent Women's Forum that has led the charge in fighting back against the insanity and trying to preserve women's sports and other rights that have become so hard won. Andrea Mew joins us now, storytelling coordinator at IWF at IWF.org. Great piece in The Federalist that you wrote. Thanks for doing that for us. I think these we're going to win the war because of pieces like this, Andrea. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. And I share your same level of optimism, which is that as much as we can continue to get the truth out, which is what my organization is focused on, is making sure the truth, the biological truth is out there, people will start to really wake up and see that, you know, organizations like the one or companies like the one that I spoke of in my article for the Federalist Target, they're promoting ideologies that are pushing children down a pipeline for medicalization, lifelong medicalization.
Yeah. And you know, if the movement is smart because they took a cue from what happened in progressive education, right? When we de-emphasize American exceptionalism, traditional American values, and that's been done for decades in public schools, government schools. If you want to change the society, you hit the kids, right? You change the kids. And that's who they're targeting. And now targeting, no pun intended, Target comes out with this. Is this the first time that they've targeted children in their Pride Month in June clothes collection, or have they done this before?
But they have put out a wide range of products for Pride Month. This one is the first that I've seen where they have had actual children's clothing, such as for children as young as newborns, where you can have the entire family be in matching Pride clothing. So your newborn can wear the same design as your toddler, as your teenager, as you.
And what's crazy is you can pick up a book or two as you ride on your Target trip. Like those toddler books that are board books, you know, one's called Bye Bye Binary. And this is not Babylon Bee stuff, right? I mean, there really is a line that says nobody puts baby in a pink or blue corner in a toddler book. Really?
Absolutely. That is the tagline of the book. And these are things that you can go to your local Target and find them on your store shelves. It's that. It's the pronoun book. They have books featuring drag queens on them, introducing the concept of drag to children. And so you can't look at these things and not assume that they are actively trying to indoctrinate children into believing all of this gender ideology nonsense.
Wow. And then, I mean, I wanted to get you on to make to like pinch myself and do a reality check here. You can buy a queer all year beanie or a super queer color block bucket hat at Target?
Absolutely. These are all products that are available right now. And it sounds like I'm promoting them right now. But no, you can go to your local Target, find these. And what's very interesting about it is, I mean, growing up, I was a little bit alternative. And so I can imagine if, you know, my friend group growing up went to their local Target and saw a queer all year beanie, they might have picked it up. The alternative crowd, they wear beanies. They might want to dress in their silly little bucket hats. And it's, you know, it's one product which leads to a kid starting to develop interest in looking these sort of things up online. Then they end up learning about a lot of these things online. And unfortunately, as we've noted in IWF's Identity Crisis documentary series by my colleague Kelsey Bowler, the online transgender communities are very active in trying to make sure that people go down this transition pipeline.
It's just really frightening. Now, it's interesting. You describe yourself as you were into the alternative at some point, presumably in your teens, right? I mean, that's usually when, you know, kids are exploring the world and who am I and what do I want to do and what's it all about, Alfie, and all of that. That's an old song you wouldn't even know. You're too young. But that's particularly cruel for adults who, while they want, I think it's, well, while I think it's really wrong to think that in any way, shape, or form that trans anything at any time is a normative behavior. We can call it a behavior we must respect. We live in a free society among adults who can choose to do what they want as long as they don't hurt others. I get that whole libertarian thing. That's fine. I tend to lean that way. But it's particularly cruel to take people that are vulnerable, and in this case, you know, ideologically vulnerable, and manipulate them in this manner by a group that has an agenda, right?
Exactly. And what you'll notice is that with a lot of these cases, there's a very strong overlap with diagnosable mental health conditions. A lot of these individuals who end up being put under a social and then medical transition could have spent more time getting work done on their mental health and should have. And that's the compassionate response. However, people who promote the transgender medical transition think that the compassionate response is to give these children any sort of procedure or pill that they want, because as one of our most recent storytellers documented in the Identity Crisis series said, oftentimes these teenagers are told, or the parents of the teenagers are told, would you rather have a dead daughter or a living son?
Wow. And that's a false choice. I mean, I've seen the data, which, of course, they say the data is bad, but that's because they don't like what the data says. And as best I can understand, if you look at the percentage of whether you're looking at suicidal ideations or anxiety, depression among youngsters, teenagers who have gender dysphoria, compared with those who have eating disorder, you know, other things. And then if you look at the suicide rates, they're almost identical. There's really not a difference. It's a mental illness, and with that carries the unfortunate tragedy that sometimes ends up in the worst outcome. And so they try to segregate this at some higher risk relative to other serious mental illnesses in children, and therefore justifying something that doesn't need justification, except it needs treatment, but not validation. We're validating something. It would like, don't you think it would be like taking an anorectic and saying, well, you know, you really like looking, being skinny, skinnier than you really are, but because you think you know, you've got a body dysmorphia. Well, why don't we just restrict some more fluids and potassium? How's that working out for you? I mean, we wouldn't do that in any other mental illness.
No, we wouldn't. And, you know, it's interesting that you'll see top mega corporations, whether it's Target, it's Apple, Google, Microsoft, even the clothing brands, Kohl's, Walmart, Dick's Sporting Goods, Levi's, you know, they all tap into Pride Month starting at June. We're about a week or so out from every single company on social media changing their logos and their profiles to have Pride flags. And some of these top mega corporations are actually lobbying states to allow for medical transition in children and claiming that it's discrimination or child abuse if these children are not allowed to transition. But like you said, can you imagine if they would be doing this to someone who was anorexic, if these were children who were bulimic, anything?
Yeah, I just, and there's another element to this that I want to get at. But first, I want to play a little bit of Riley Gaines' testimony in front of Congress the other day for you and have your reaction to that. Take a listen.
Describe that locker room experience to this committee, please.
First of all, we were not forewarned we would be sharing a changing space. No one told us. No one asked for our consent. We did not give our consent to undress in front of a male. Yet the only time we became aware of this was when it was presented in front of us and it was too late. So what that kind of looked like in the vein of being extremely transparent, a 6'4", he's actually taller than 6'1", a 6'4" male walks in, disrobes, and is fully intact with male genitalia while we're simultaneously undressing as 18 to 22-year-old girls, and we could do nothing about it. I actually immediately left the locker room, and I went up to one of the officials on the pool deck, and I said, how is this allowed to happen? You know, I understand the guidelines for the competition, but what are the guidelines in regards to the locker room? And he looks at me and word for word says, oh, we actually got around this by making the locker rooms unisex, so it's not a big deal. And I thought about that, and unisex, So this meant that any man could have walked into our locker room, not just a self-identifying female. Any man, any coach, any parent, any official, any man who wanted to would have had full access to, and bare minimum, we weren't forewarned. And actually, Leah Thomas's teammates, who dealt with this every single day all year, when they expressed their discomfort to their administration and they sent an email, and I swear I have a screenshot of their response, their administration responded back with, if you feel uncomfortable seeing male genitalia, here's some counseling resources that you should seek.
What an affront to our sensibilities, Andrea. I mean, what an affront to women's sensibilities and their very decency and their just right to privacy, for crying out loud. And how can we get around the fact that the decision makers in the academy, the boardroom, and large swaths of our governance are okay with this sort of movement towards unisex? There are no sexual distinctions. How do we fight back?
Right. Well, I mean, and the first thing that stood out to me about Riley's testimony right there, and we're so proud of her testimony. Every time she speaks, she's an incredible voice to have on the IWF team. What's really shocking to me is how it seems like these individuals care so much more about protecting the mental health of the so-called transgender children, teenagers, and yet they don't seem to care at all about the mental health of young women who are exposed to male genitalia in these locker rooms. And this isn't happening in every single school, no, but you're going to start to see it happen a lot more frequently. And it's just quite sad that, you know, no matter how many puberty blockers, no matter how many hormones that you put these teenagers, these biological males on, they're never going to have a woman's body parts. And so they should not be in the same locker room as a woman.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, you just wonder what's next. I shudder to think. Now, I'm happy to see that more and more female athletes, more and more women athletes are standing down. They may compete, but as she said in another testimony, they're not going to take the stand, the awards stand, and take a second or third as she had to do. Will we get to a point where they think they'll be widespread, just walkouts? They just won't compete because women need to put their feet down and say, this is enough, just enough.
You know, these are some of the rumors I have been hearing buzzing around from women online who are furious about the state of women's sports. They're the types of women who are engaged and ready to sign petitions telling the NCAA we need to stop discriminating against female athletes. And I do think at some point you will start to see people stand up and protest, physically protest at these sporting events.
Yeah. Yeah, I am glad to see that. I think it's like the Jedi versus the Empire in the old Star Wars. It's like this is a titan battle for our culture, and it's nothing to sneeze at. A lot of people say, well, come on, with all what's going on in the world, the economy and a war in Ukraine. Well, if you lose your culture, you lose your country, you lose your freedom, and in this case, you lose your identity in some cases, you know. And I just think it's a fight that needs to be fought.
You do, and it also pushes children down this pipeline to be medicalized for life. They are going to be permanent patients to these surgical procedures that they have had done to themselves, or even just the puberty blockers or the extra added hormones during their social and then medical transition can have very long-lasting effects on their bodies. And we actually don't know the full long-term effect of these because they haven't been around for that long. Yeah. So you're thinking about a future generation of Americans who are even more potentially unhealthy than the generation of Americans we have right now.
Well, you're talking to someone that has a fair amount of professional experience in reproductive endocrinology, and I am terrified about the experiment we are doing on an entire generation. I have likened it to the Tuskegee experiment. It's not to minimalize what happened to black men with syphilis back in the early 1900s at all, but it's of that a scope, I think, and a wider magnitude. Well, it's a wider, it's that same scope, but a wider magnitude, right? It's not just one area, it's an entire country. We're doing this to an entire generation. I know we only ask for normally 15 minutes, but we have a caller on the line, and this is such a pivotal topic and such a critical one. Would you take a call?
Of course.
Okay. Andrea Mew is with us. She's the storytelling coordinator. We have to find out what that means. I'm fascinated by that topic. That's fun. And then I want to tell you about a caller we had in the first segment, because your creative instincts will enjoy it. Greg is on the line. Greg, you're on with Andrea. Go ahead.
Hey, I was just, you know, it's insanity what's going on. It was just funny or ironic or whatever that somebody like Kid Rock could stand up and make a little bit of a statement, and it hurt the pocketbook of Bud Light, and they got rid of the person in charge of the fiascos. So I hear, and I think the big thing is that people are just going to have to say no, quit going to events. I used to listen to Glenn Beck a lot. For years he was against boycotts, and I'm like, you know, we got a boycott. As a consumer, say, hey, I'm not going to buy from that company. And stand by it. I mean, about the only way we can hurt these people is in the pocketbook. It's insanity.
You have to fight with the resources you have, and the man and woman on the street that don't have the voice that politicians, you know, CEOs of corporations, you know, the dean of the schools have. You got to fight with what you have.
Okay. Well, what's going on with the women swimmers and something? That is insanity, okay. And I'm all for them fighting.
Okay, thanks. So are you in favor of boycotts? How do you feel about that? Or on the flip side, boycotts, where we look for opportunities to patronize organizations, Andrea, that celebrate traditional distinctions and gender roles and so forth?
Oh, absolutely. Boycotts are the way to go. Boycotts can work, of course, but, you know, you really have to stick to your convictions. Oftentimes we'll see with conservatives, we'll start a boycott, and a few weeks later, it fizzles out. Boycotts are so strong because where the crowd gathers, the market will follow. Yeah. And, you know, if these companies are, if they care more about wokeness than their profits, and they're trying to fuel this with ESG policies, all of these left-leaning companies, they will start to financially struggle if we put our money where our mouth is and, you know, seek that mentality as often as possible.
Yeah, yeah. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you something that's troubled me as a male talk show host, because there's around this whole topic, you know, how sometimes you don't have a real good voice at the table because it can come off sounding, you know, either, well, it can come off sounding weird. But I heard Megyn Kelly on her podcast with Carrie Prejean Boiler and Britt Mayer, who I think they were Miss America candidates from, or Miss California, and they're part of the movement now. Megyn Kelly says she's going to join a protest. She would have never thought she'd have done that. I mean, everyone's getting fired up. But part of the discussion, I was glad to hear it as a guy who loves to listen to Sinatra and songs like Come Fly With Me, Let's Go to Peru. You know, we're going to have a great time, and I know a guy that'll play his flute. I'm a romantic traditionalist, okay, and I honor women, right? These women validated that, and that they validated. They talked about we're at risk of losing the sexuality and the sensuality and what makes women special and what makes guys, well, we're not very special, but you know what I mean. You know what I'm getting at here. Now, if I sound like a you know, misogynistic pig, you know, and that's not the point here.
Oh, no. Not at all. In fact, I actually firmly agree with you that we should have a little bit more of a division between what is a woman and what is a man. This is something that I'm deeply passionate about. I also write for a magazine, Evie Magazine, and we write all about truth and femininity, because the female identity has been, you know, it's been challenged over the years. Mm-hmm. So many of young women were told that they had to go out and be girl bosses. They had to be the boss babe. They had to act like men. And there is a very significant movement of young women who are now feeling like they want this sort of unconstrained, authentic femininity, you know, re-embracing actually being a woman and re-embracing men being men and being okay with men having their own spaces.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, just the old, it almost seems like anymore if we recognize as a biological phenomenon that, you know, the art of romance, sort of that the game that people play, you know, to go back to an old song, that used to be something that was considered a biological reality. And while civility needed to remain, and obviously, you know, those kind of things can go south, it seems like that is dishonored these days, you know. And it's like, boy, if a guy isn't more sensitive and if a woman isn't more guy-like, well, there's something wrong with you. I don't know. That's a discussion for another day. I don't know. One last thing before we leave. A caller before the first break, you'll get a kick out of this, as a storyteller. We were talking about rainbows and unicorns for Pride Month, and she said, hey, why don't we do a heterosexual symbol, the narwhal? How creative is that? Let's have, instead of unicorns, we're going to have narwhal. Maybe we'll make it blue and pink. I don't know. Hey, it's been a delight talking with you. I hope you can join us again. And again, we can read your great work on, The Federalist, IWF.org, or EVIE, right? EVIE?
Yeah. Right. Yes, you can find all of my work on IWF.org, EVIE Magazine. This particular op-ed was from The Federalist, about Target's Pride Month collection. But yes, thank you so much for having me on.
You and the entire group of ladies at the IWF are my passion to promote, because I every week we talk with you, and you guys are hitting it out of the park. So thank you so very much, and have a great weekend.
Appreciate that. You have a great weekend, too.
All right. There she is, Andrea Mugh. Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to be talking with Cindy O'Loughlin after the top of the hour news. And then Larry Behrens about our energy calamity. Thank you, Joe Biden and the administration. That'll be at 7:25. 7:45, Virginia Cruda. I can't wait to talk to her about the happenings of the day. Ask her if she'd like to see Anton model a one-piece swimsuit. I'm still working on that. He says his legs are too hairy, but we're going to see. And then Dr. Dan Cusimano at 8 o'clock, and at 8:25, Joel Gilbert. Should Michelle Obama be, will she be, the dark horse candidate, maybe, for the Democratic nomination for president? Interesting theory. We'll talk with him then. Now, you know, from time to time, we have fun with Joe Biden and his gaffes, and Kamala Harris and her word salad. They are the masters of those two respective skills. But I believe we should be equal opportunity truth seekers, right? That's what we do here. And when one on our side makes a big goof, you got to call it out, whether it's a policy wise or whether it's a maybe being unprepared for what's a major announcement. And I speak of one, Marjorie Taylor Greene. I think Marjorie Taylor Greene is a net negative for the Republican, and especially for the conservative movement, because she's hyperbolic. She's says things that are often require us to wear a tinfoil hat. And that is not good when it comes to, maybe good for the base. Maybe some of you and I find her entertaining, some of which I agree. But when it comes to appealing to the middle, you have to be careful. Well, this week she announced articles of impeachment to be filed against Joe Biden. This was her announcement statement. I want you to listen carefully. Listen to what she says.
It is with the highest amount of solemnity that I announce my intention to introduce articles of impeachment today on the head of this America at Last executive branch that has been working since January 20th, 2021, to systematically destroy this country. The President of the United States, Joseph Robinette Biden. Joe Biden has deliberately compromised our national.
Now, Anton, you know, like I say, I call balls and strikes. I don't care whether they got an elephant on their shirt or a donkey on their shirt. You know what I mean? Play the beginning of this again, and you tell me. She was looking at a speech, a written speech, and this is inexcusable for a politician making a major announcement like this, and it discredits her when she's already under a lot of scrutiny for her sometimes fringe thoughts. Take a listen.
It is with the highest amount of solemnity that I announce
There you go.
It is with the highest amount.
Whoop, finger slip.
Anton, What was she trying to say? She was trying to say with the highest amount of solemnity. 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 That's sort of like true in the bush, but a baguette. You remember what
Biden I remember said? That. Yeah. From the last time. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, and you might say, Randy, don't be so petty. No, I look, if you're making a major announcement and you're reading a speech as she was doing, you got to rehearse it. You got to get it right. And you have to be able to pronounce words like solemnity. Not solemnity. Or is it solemn Rushdie? Or is it either true in the bush, running but butter? I don't know. Anyway, I mean, it may be a little thing, but in this hypercharged political environment where everything you say in a political environment is scrutinized with a fine-tooth comb, especially by a media that is about anything to destroy you, it is very, very important you get it right. So, Marjorie... next time, read the speech once or twice in front of a mirror before you give it. Might be a good idea. Might be a good idea. We've got to get, I don't think we have time, but I want to make sure and get to the debt ceiling talks. You know, they took a pause yesterday for just a little bit. The GOP walked away because they said, hey, the administration officials that are negotiating on the debt ceiling and fiscal restraint talks, are just not being, they're disingenuous. They're not being serious minded and we're walking away. Then it was announced they were going to work deep into the night. Haven't seen any reporting this morning that anything came of that, but if it does, we'll let you know. I'm glad McCarthy and the conservative caucus are sticking tight. It's good. It's just a little bit of fiscal, sanity we need to bring to the table. When we come back, Cindy O'Loughlin on what happened in the Missouri legislature with super majorities. Ugh. Cindy O'Loughlin is of course, the floor leader joins us now from the Northeast Missouri District and formerly my state senator and good friend. How you doing, Cindy? Good to have you with me.
I'm doing really well. How are you doing, Randy?
I am doing well. I think I am joined by a number, and probably you too, as well as Bill Igel, who we talked with Monday. Frustration that with all these huge majorities, a lot of things didn't make it across the finish line that I guess there was a lot of excitement that there would, like education and initiative petition and on and on and on. What's your analysis of what came down last week as the session closed?
Well, I mean, I think I would have to start by saying that there were two sort of competing visions of the initiative petition reform that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. One being that if we got it done this last session, you know, it'd be plenty of time ahead of time and we'd need to do it and, you know, kind of that line of thinking. But there also developed over the course of the session the line of thinking that if you went back to Cleaner Missouri, that was kind of a winning formula for our side of the aisle. And of course that was done after Clean Missouri was passed. We knew the wording of it. We knew what we had to defeat and we're able to come up with an initiative petition, that would defeat it. And we did defeat it. So of course our side of the chamber came up with their vision, which was you had to achieve above a certain percent and or you had to get concurrent majorities in, I think, 5 of the 8 congressional districts. The thinking being that what happens is the urban areas overrule the rural areas. So if you go back and look at, like, recreational marijuana and some of the other things that have, you know, passed successfully, they basically pass with votes from Springfield, Columbia, St. Louis, Kansas City, and the entire rest of the state votes against it. So Andrew Koenig was the author of that and Sandy Crawford, and we passed that version, sent it to the House, and they stripped off the concurrent majority. So I think in the end it came down to thinking maybe we can come up with a better version. It wouldn't go on the ballot until August of 2024, and it would be effective when the thing that people most want to defeat is an effort to expand abortion, which mm-hmm. will be on the ballot in November of 2024. So that was kind of the thinking, and I have to say that I'm not entirely opposed to that thinking. I would have voted for the version that we had. I didn't think the version that the House sent back really helped us in the way of getting more of a rural voice representation. So that's kind of what happened with the initiative petition.
How about education choice?
Yeah, education reform. Andrew was also the author of that legislation, and we have to have 18 votes. And it seemed to me that to get a little bit of open enrollment choice, where parents could send their children to a school not in their home zip code, but, you know, essentially to any other zip code if that school was participating. And I felt like that was a pretty minimal change, really. And in return for that, I felt the bill just got stacked with so many giveaways to, you know, the public education establishment, and kind of ran into a little bit of trouble with that. But we did have 18 votes. And then one of the senators had a daughter become ill, have an emergency birth of a child. She became ill, had to go to the hospital, had a baby. So that member had to leave. That left us a vote short. So that's kind of what happened there.
Well, that same kind of a thing happened on the Medicaid, the postpartum Medicaid bill. I'm reading from the Missouri Independent's reporting on this, said that when Senator Moon blocked all action in the Senate in retribution for the chamber approving a postpartum Medicaid bill days earlier while he was absent. I don't know if that's the same issue, the same absence.
No, different one.
Yeah.
No, because I don't think Senator Moon would vote for education reform, and that's kind of another strange thing that has sort of popped up. We have a small group of people who say they want education reform. In fact, some are members of the former conservative caucus. Mm-hmm. That I fondly call the Chaos Caucus, and they're not for open enrollment. So,
Wait a minute. That's news to my ears. What do you mean? I thought that was one of their big deals.
Well, I'm glad you have me on today, because Senator Igel and I have sort of a tortured relationship. We actually get along, but we do argue pretty strongly. And one of the things that seems to happen with him is he champions things that the right, people on the right side of the aisle would normally champion, like lower taxes and education choice and that kind of thing. And as you know, in this session, we passed the Parents' Bill of Rights at the first of the session. We passed Save Women's Sports at the first of the session. We had spring break, like about a week early. And the day we got back, we passed prohibiting any kind of surgery or hormone treatment on minors, which is happening to children who may think they're transgender, or maybe their parents think they're transgender. So we did pass some pretty hefty issues at the first of the session. And, of course, there are lots of bills pertaining to lots of issues. And we come down towards the budget and the end of session, and that seems to be when chaos takes hold. And we had that this year. And generally it is members of the Chaos Caucus who want to pass their bills but have not really created the relationships within the chamber that you need to have in order to get it done. And one of the things that was going on was protesting the landfill that was going into a residential area around the Kansas City area. This brought on a filibuster the day before, well, actually the day that we were to take in at least three of the budget bills. anyway, in order to stop that, we sat down and talked through, you know, how do we get everything done that we feel is important that we can get done. We had an agreement. This did include Senator Igel, Senator Bratton, Senator Hoskins, and basically the personal property tax would have gone on there, and some of the things that Hoskins wanted, a year delay in the landfill decision, which is sort of unrelated, but, you know, is what kind of sparked that final issue. And those bills were sent to the House. The Senate chamber passed them all over to the House. And then included in that deal was the agreement that we would not have filibusters and tying up of the Senate chamber in return for that. And that was on Friday. And on Monday of the last week, chaos started. And we were told, look, if the House doesn't move these bills fast enough, we're going to slow things down on the Senate side because that's a way of putting pressure on the House. Well, you know, I thought that was not right, and I said so, but it just ratcheted up every single day to where they killed a lot of time. Ultimately, so infuriating the Senate chamber that, you know, some of the things they wanted to pass didn't go through. So there's sort of a disturbing trend of going to people and saying, you know, I'm for this particular issue, which a lot of people identify with. As I said, property tax relief, those kind of things. But then somehow the people carrying the bills then also get involved in ways of obstructing the business of the Senate to where those things do not pass. And I would remind people, last year, the Senate adjourned a day early when we had a CRT trans bill ready to go. And that early dismissal was negotiated by Senator Igel with the minority leader and with Senator Rowden, who was kind of stuck between a rock and a hard spot. And that legislation didn't pass last year. And then that was used against a lot of the people who ran last year and had primaries saying that, hey, they didn't support this. Well, they did support it. We had a promise that it would come to the floor that day. And then, you know, session ended a day early. So I think sometimes people want to run for other offices, or they, you know, who knows what their ultimate goal is, but they use these things as political theater and as sometimes a way really to bludgeon some of their opponents. And I don't like that.
Yeah.
I called them out for it.
Yeah, you did. I read from the report that said that, you know, basically summarized what you had said. You were quoted in the news report, basically the same kind of stuff you just ran through. And Bill Igel was like, no, this isn't personal. We get along fine. It's just that he felt as though I got the sense that he really, the message that I ultimately heard was that he was, you and Senator Rowden were the messengers, and it wasn't about you, it was about the message that he disagreed with. What is this sense that we get from Senator Igel, and how do you answer it, that his property tax bill, which he claims has more support than, there's less division on that issue among the caucus than there is about the sports betting, was held hostage, in my words, held hostage to the Senate, to the sports betting bill?
Well, I can understand why he would put it in those terms, but sports betting wasn't even a part of the agreement that we had on Friday of of the week preceding the final week. Mm-hmm. Because Senator Hoskins has, you know, sort of doubled down on blocking that. And I'm not a big gambler and I wouldn't vote for it anyway. But, you know, a lot of people feel like it's harmless fun, whether that's really true or not. But that was not part of our agreement. You know, we had it set up where he would get his property tax cut, and Senator Hoskins did have some other things he wanted. Those things were included, and the child care tax credit package was included to sort of help promote daycares and try to find an answer to the daycare issue. And it was only until we started having obstructionist tactics being used Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, that on Friday, I mean, basically everything was dead. And so I asked them to meet with me. That would be Senator Hoskins and Igel. And we met with Senator Rowden. And I said, you know, everybody in the chamber is furious because basically you've killed a lot of people's legislation that would have gone through in this last week. If you want your property tax to go through or any of these other things, probably the only way you can get it is to add sports betting, because lots of people have tried to pass that for the last, mm-hmm. I don't know, it seems like ever since I've been there. And, you know, they refused to do that.
So this was a matter of give a little to get a lot. I mean, that's the nature of legislation, isn't it? I mean, don't you don't always, even Ronnie Reagan said, what, if you get 80% of what you want, it's a great day.
Yes, but, you know, sometimes I think they can't understand that. The Senate is a complicated place, but I do believe that it's filled with people who will work with you, regardless of whether they agree with you entirely or not. I mean, the personal property tax issue, of course, has been a big issue for Senator Igel for at least 3 years. And the big problem has been for the rural areas. So, like, the first year that he brought it up, I said, well, you know, nobody likes paying personal property tax, but I need to think about that because I'm not sure how that would work for the rural areas, because it pays for, you know, our roads, our police, our schools, our nursing homes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're in St. Charles County, where you have all kinds of retail and you're the fastest growing county in the state, well, it's not that big a deal, maybe. But, you know, for us in the rural area, which is 80% of our state, it is a big deal. And really, even if you got rid of it entirely, and it's millions of dollars, what you're basically doing is turning around and putting all of the tax on the people who own real estate. So you're not actually doing away with it. You're just only making one side of the spectrum pay tax and pay a whole lot more.
Mm. So shifting.
So,
I see.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've never thought that that was really a great solution, and yet, you know, this last year, people who had used vehicles saw their tax on those used vehicles skyrocket. And ultimately, that is part of what, you know, was agreed to. It was a much scaled down version of personal property tax relief. And it would have gone through. I mean, the entire chamber was ready to pass that. But, you know, their actions killed it.
So what I'm hearing is, they were saying one thing but doing another in terms of the support of their own bill. Perhaps, my words again, for grandstanding, to get some, to keep it as a wedge issue that they can then use in a campaign. I mean, right? That's what I'm
absolutely
hearing.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, that's my,
yeah,
that's my thinking. And, of course, Bill knows I think that. He and I are quite frank with each other. We sit right beside each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a smart and talented guy, but sometimes those games go a little bit too far. They did go too far last year. I think a lot of senators felt, you know, that there were things published about them that simply were not true, and that did happen. And so that created, you know, at the beginning of the year, some pretty harsh feelings. Yeah. And, you know, senators have a lot of power, every individual senator. So in order to get everybody to work together, it takes quite a lot of negotiation and working at that relationship. And if you don't work at that relationship, it can really jeopardize everything you want to do.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's frustrating for us who watch other states that don't have the alignment of the governor's mansion and the majorities in both chambers of their legislatures passing things like dollar follows the scholar for school. Not just open enrollment, but I mean, you know, hey, here's $7,500, spend it how you want. Arizona, Iowa, you know, and it's almost like if the voters are like parents, I'm afraid they're going to say, hey, we walked in on a fight. I don't know who started the fight, but I'm frustrated with the whole bunch of you. You're grounded for a week, you know, and I'm just worried that may happen to a lot of very good people, you know, in the Senate. That's what I'm worried.
Well, I mean, it bothers me, too, and I do my best to get out to people and talk to people and let them know what's happening. I do think it would help, like on the education issue. I don't know anybody that's been more involved in that than I have. I visited over 30 schools and was the chairman of education. And, right. You know, I have consistently recommended we change the leadership at DESE. It's not working. There's too many people working there, and yet our outcomes are not good.
Right.
And, you know, really, you have to have a governor who wants to really dig down deep and address some of these issues. Yep. And that really has not been
a priority. Yeah, not a priority. Well, we're up against a break. I can't thank you enough for really helping bringing some interesting information and some behind-the-scenes information, which is rare from a leader in the political circles. I thank you for being so helpful with this. And about that little deal that was cut that maybe the other side didn't abide by Friday before the end. Thanks very much, Cindy.
Thanks, Randy, for having me on.
Always appreciate it. Let's talk again.
All righty.
Well, we're back, and we thank Larry Behrens for yielding some of his time to Cindy O'Loughlin. It was an important thing that you hear what's going on in the Missouri legislature and some of the dysfunction there. So, Larry, thank you for being with me. Larry Behrens is the communications director for Power the Future and brings us some chilling news about Biden energy policy again. How you doing this morning, Larry? Is the gas stove all fired up?
That's right. And the bacon is cooking, and I'm sure somewhere, you know, AOC is shedding a tear over both of those things. Absolutely. How are you, Randy?
I'm doing good. Hey, I read a piece that you wrote in the Daily Caller, and it's really chilling what's going on. I think we think about the assault on several levels of our energy access and affordability by the Biden administration within our homes and in our power plants. And we think of it in terms of our personal economic security, not, I mean, and how much more energy is costing us. But the fact that you say it actually is benefiting Biden, you know, and his minions as well, right? Politically, I don't think we put that together all the time. So explain.
Yeah. And so I just had to look at the timing of it. And I started, you know, raising a few questions in my mind. Within the last 4 months, you know, they've come after our gas stoves. They've come after our dishwasher. They've looked at our air conditioner. They don't like our lawnmowers. There's a whole bunch of things. And they're coming after farm equipment. There's a whole bunch of things. I'm like, why in the last 4 months? I mean, he's been in office 2+ years now. Why do this? Well, first of all, the two things struck out to me. One is all of that happened around the time he's announcing his reelection, correct? And the second part is all of that is happening by executive order, executive fiat, executive decree, because I guess he's just crowned himself the Green King. And so he doesn't want to take any of these things through Congress, and he's starting to launch a ton of them when he's doing his reelection bid. And it's like, it must be to get that green money in his coffers, because he knows by this time next year, it'll probably be much, much less desirable. In fact, we've already seen him kind of do a shake to back to the middle now, getting ready for his reelect. And so this is why he's putting all these radical things in place now. And forget what it, you know, costs the American family, which, by the way, it's about $78,000 if you want to comply with everything. It is something that is just makes Biden's eco donors really, really happy.
Yeah, I mean, there's this, it reminds me of the of the government employees unions and the interesting little, you know, cabal they have with their with their bosses, yeah. the legislators, who then vote in great, you know, terms of their employment. And in terms, the union then, you know, contributes to their campaigns. It's really the same book, just a different chapter, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's a great racket if you can get it. You know, before I started with Power of the Future, I worked in the education space, did media relations there. And I got to be honest, I saw more than a few superintendents go before legislators and say, you guys are giving us a 5% cut. And we were looking around and like, no, we're giving you a 5% increase. I'm like, no, you don't understand. We were expecting a 10% increase, but you're only giving us a 5% increase. So therefore, it's a 5% cut. And these were folks that were, you know, it's really interesting. They were elected by, or they're hired by a school board. School board elections were in February with usually like a 1% turnout. And so, yeah, their union bosses drove a bunch of that turnout. And so the superintendents did what the unions wanted them to do. And so it's really nice when you have sway over your boss, because lo and behold, the raises start coming a whole lot. Like I said, it's a great racket if you can get it.
Yeah, yeah. I think it caught my attention about 10 seconds later here on a Saturday morning, but did you say that to fully comply with all of the home appliance, gas stove, dishwasher, so forth, all of those things, it would cost the average household $17,000?
No, it would cost $78,000.
Oh, $78,000. Whoa, 78,000. Yeah. How do we come up with that? I guess I misheard.
Yeah.
Holy cow, 17 is bad enough. How do we get to 78?
You're going to need a new furnace. You're going to need a new air conditioner. You're going to need a new electric stove. You're going to need a new dishwasher that uses less water. And get ready for it. You're going to need a new car, because your car is not going to work under what Joe Biden wants to start selling within the next 7 years. And so that's $66,000 by itself. And 78,000, I'm sorry to tell you, Randy, is a conservative number, because that's if your household only has one car. If you have more than one car, well, then add another 66,000 on top of that. That's the average price of a fully electric vehicle. This Green New Deal that Joe Biden is putting through by executive order, not running it through Congress, It is going to cost us so much money. Yeah, so if you want to comply, that's the cost. You know, it's $1,000 here, maybe for a new electric stove, and maybe you have to get your house retrofitted to get rid of that gas line, and then your furnace and your air conditioner, those are chunks of change. But full disclosure, most of that is going to be in the new vehicle Joe Biden wants you to buy. Keep in mind, he doesn't drive one himself.
Now, I have to just recall that just a few years ago, when Donald Trump was in office, we were energy independent. When fossil fuels our economy at affordable prices, our economy goes red hot and everything works well. And by the way, there was low inflation too, so it's a wonderful you know, combination. It's a wonderful equation. And I'm thinking, not only you were talking of the 78K is probably capital costs, right? My electricity bills have gone up, and I'm getting notices from the electric co-op and the electric company, you know, that say, well, the reason it's gone up is because our costs have gone up, and it's not all just supply chain stuff either. It's because of the mandates for, you know, tooling up for and purchasing alternative power. Won't the electric power to power those vehicles also add to that number on a long-term basis as well? I mean, compared to formerly affordable fossil fuel?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, as they're looking at, including in Missouri this summer, the worry about blackouts, because we have, you know, forced reliable power plants offline because Joe Biden has a crazy green agenda. We're worried that we're not going to have enough megawatts to keep the lights on as it is. And you're exactly right, Randy. So, you know, let's start an electric stove with that. Let's start an electric car with that, and make the electricity demand at each house go through the roof at a time when the price of electricity is going higher and when we don't have enough of it. It makes absolutely no sense. And that's why, you know, you compared it to 3-4 years ago, and it's a great comparison, because, you know what, I remember the last administration didn't have to force us to do anything. This green movement, we're told over and over, it's more affordable, it's better, we have better products, you'll like it. And yet they have to continually, you know, use executive orders or the full weight of the bureaucracy to force us to buy it. If it's so great, why do you have to force us to buy it? Nobody had to force me to buy my iPhone. I just thought, hey, this is a good product I'd like to have around and use. And that's not the case of their, you know, little glorified golf carts and so forth. And so now they're making it so they have to force us to do it. And that is not what the free market's about. And when you take out the free market, what happens? A lot of people get rich, and it's not you and me, Randy.
Yeah. Yeah, talking with Larry Behrens, the communications director for Power of the Future. Larry, you know, we've talked already about the, on the back of questionable, if not unconstitutional, abuse of executive orders, capital expenses going through the roof for Americans when already 40% of people say they can't pay their month-to-month bills. I mean, they're scrambling.
Yeah.
Ongoing cost of the power, the electric power to power those new vehicles and appliances. But I sound like the Flex Seal guy. But wait, that's more. There's more. What about increased taxes in the long run to subsidize the infrastructure needs to for the power grid, which is not ready for prime time anyway?
Yeah, there is a ton of hidden costs because the government's going to get its cut too, right? In the terms of taxes, it was really interesting this week, and it's something that I know you were talking about the Missouri legislature, something that maybe they can consider here in Missouri in the future. The governor of Texas signed a law saying, hey, you know what? If you're going to have that EV and you're not going to buy gasoline because the gasoline tax is what keeps the roads in decent shape or helps us fund the roads, then we're going to raise your costs for registering that EV. You're going to have to pay an extra $200 to register the EV, and I think it's $100 a month after that. And EV owners were so mad, like, how dare you? How dare you? Now, let's be honest. The average income for an EV owner is $150,000 a year, and so when they talk about the rich paying their fair share, it is those ones that own the EV and saying, oh, how dare you raise these prices on us? It's something to consider for Missouri. But on the flip side of that, we don't really talk about, and at least the green movement doesn't really talk about, the effect on the poor. So if let's say I scrape together that $78K to comply with Joe Biden's mandates, but I live in an apartment, where am I going to charge my EV? Where am I going to get the electricity for it? Do I have to run extension cord for my apartment? If I'm a college student, do I have to run it from my dorm to the EV? How is that going to work? Or do I have to, you know, wait like we do at the airport sometimes looking for an outlet to charge our phone, except at this time it'll be our car that we depend on. There's no discussion on how it hurts the poor.
Well, you know what's going to happen. No matter whether you're in rural Missouri or urban Missouri, it doesn't matter. When more infrastructure is needed, charging stations. By the way, those electric vehicles weigh more on just a passenger vehicle weighs more. You're talking about stress on the roads. You're talking about stress on parking facilities. What municipalities and other political subdivisions are going to have to raise taxes to pay for infrastructure. So you're going to pay on so many levels. It is infuriating. It is the most regressive tax I could ever imagine, although not called a tax, and that is this whole mandated green movement. And it's just, I'm so glad you're pointing it out. It's just, it's unbelievable. I saw on your Twitter feed, which is at Larry Behrens,
something right about,
is it New Mexico that was ballyhooing the fact that they were, 9% alternative energy? I thought I saw that.
Yeah, you know, I live here in Missouri now, but I am a blue state refugee from New Mexico. And when people have to understand, New Mexico has just adopted the California, New York, Joe Biden model to a T. And they've decided that they're going to get rid of all their fossil fuel generated electricity, I think, within the next 20 years or so. And so they're happily doing it now. And so their utility puts up a thing of, look how much renewable energy is powering our state. And it was a whopping 9%. By their own mandate, it's supposed to be at least 20% all the time right now. And so this is what happens. You know, politicians pass these rules and say, just like Joe Biden, in the year 2035 or the year 2040, it'll be like this. They know they'll be out of office when that happens. They know they won't have to live with the consequences. But, you know, all their green friends do the golf clap and send the money, and it doesn't matter how it ruins our lives and how it drives up our prices and doesn't make a difference, you know, for our citizens other than to make things harder to come by. And so, yeah, blue state refugee I am, and that's a big reason why.
Yeah. Well, Larry, we thank you and everyone at Power the Future, powerthefuture.com, for bringing, really, you're the Paul Revere's of this movement. And I think maybe the next time we get together, we need to figure out a strategy on how to convince rational people, if there are any remaining in Congress, especially on the blue side of the aisle, that, okay, I'll I'll take your alternative energy and I'll raise you one. It's called clean nuclear power. That's safe now with new modular units. Perhaps we can talk about that in our next discussion, because I think that's the answer that everyone should agree on.
That's a great point. Don't have to mandate anything. Use what works, Randy. You're absolutely right.
Right. Hey, thanks, Larry, for being with me. Appreciate it. And enjoy your bacon on the gas stove this morning.
Thanks so much, Randy. Have a great day.
All right. Great when we get together with Virginia Cruda, who is so prolific in her work. I don't know how she has a normal life to write all of the stuff she does here at Daily Wire, here on Newstalk STL, and on the air work. I don't know. How do you... You need more hours in the day, Virginia. I don't know how you get it all done, but it's great work you do.
And I read and write really fast. That's really all there is to it.
Well, hey, I want to ask you about a story that you wrote about on the Daily Wire, and I covered it on my weekday show in Columbia. And I'm not going to waste our time playing the clip, but boy, Elon Musk was on fire in a CNBC interview last week, and he basically said to the laptop class, get off your feet and get back to work. He's against remote working. He sounded like some 60-year-old fuddy-duddy, out of the past. I mean, what's happened with Elon? You work remotely,
don't you? I mean, I've been working remote since 2015. So like before the pandemic was a thing, before everybody else had to work remote, that's what I've been doing. But that's because a lot of what I cover is in Washington, D.C., and I am not.
Yeah.
So, and I think it depends on the job you're doing, too, whether or not working remote is feasible. And, there are people who can handle it and people who can't, because, like, for me, it's the way I've been working, like I said, since 2015. But I am motivated to get work done. And there are people who really struggle with that. Like if I'm at home, I get distracted by the TV. I get distracted by kids. I get distracted by the fact that I haven't done the laundry yet, or I haven't done, this, that, and the other. And there are people who cannot get through those distractions and be productive.
I think he was going at it also, not from a pragmatic viewpoint, like, can you get work done? He talked about productivity, but if you listen to the clip, he used the word moral. He thinks it's immoral. And the reason being that, there are people in every workplace that have to be at work, and it creates sort of a caste system mentality where, like, gosh darn it, I can tell you, I was running a hospital in rural Missouri and practicing. Yeah. And there began to be some, when some of the billing staff and some of the coding staff were by necessity, in some cases because of the workforce shortage, in other cases because of the reality of the workforce shortage, basically people said, look, I can go work for someone else remote, or I'll work for you. And it's like, okay. But you could hear the murmurs in the hallways, at the lunchroom. Yeah. Yeah, I got to come to work because I got to put an IV in someone, and I've got to, take care of someone's baby. Yeah. And deliver. And they love that. But I think it creates some hazard in terms of intra-corporate relationships. What say you?
I think that you're right. I think that it is a little different, again, in the business that I'm in, because since the advent of the digital news source, I think my workplace has kind of been half remote and half in person really from the beginning. So there wasn't so much as that. It wasn't that people were hired to work there and then decided to go remote because of the pandemic, because they were scared, because they could, and you couldn't stop them. It wasn't like that. It was the people who worked remote were hired to work remote.
Yeah.
And
right. I mean, like that was their job description.
Yeah.
Right,
and
right.
So I think it's a little bit different. You don't see quite as much of the, well, I don't have to come to the office thing. You don't see as much of that. And then, the main side effect and if or benefit, if you will, from working remote is that you don't always have to attend certain meetings and things that would be, bog you down if you were in an office. Well, because everything is digital now, you have to attend those too because they've got you on a Zoom call and now you're stuck in the meeting whether you're in the office or not. Yeah. And
you can't dare anymore. You can't get away with turning off your screen because you're, you know, reading a novel you know, whatever.
So to a degree, I don't think, especially in my line of work, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference whether you're remote or in the office. You just, you know, might be able to grab a quick snack from the kitchen a little easier if you're at home than if you're in the office. But, you know, I've been in the Daily Wire's office. They have a really nice kitchen and you can go get a snack anytime you want. So it's really not, they've done a really good job of making the office feel like a second home. So I think that it's very, I don't see a whole lot of that real dichotomy in my particular job, but I can see how it would be in certain jobs. Or like if you work at Walmart and like the office manager doesn't have to, like the personnel guy doesn't have to come in, but everybody else does. Right. Or, you know, I think that in certain businesses, having people in the office is very, very important. And in some businesses, it's less so. But if you're doing it because you're afraid at this point, or if you're doing it because if you're going remote just because you can, as opposed to because there's an actual benefit to you working remote.
Right.
Then
maybe a problem.
I can see why he would make that point.
Yeah. And I think especially for the white collar class, the administrative class in an organization, worst thing you can do is abuse that privilege. You're already privileged because you're the boss or you're the CMO or the CFO or the COO. You know, my gosh, you should be down there. I mean, I remember Gussie Bush. That was his secret. He was always, even though he was enormously wealthy, owned the brewery. I remember brewmasters and others working on the floor said, man, God, he'd come down there and he'd just hang out with us, drink a beer. You know, he was part of the crew. And that was Donald Trump's secret, too, because he was always on the construction site. It was reported anyway. In the last minute and a half we have or so, I don't know if you shop at Target. If you do or if you did, would you consider, because of their move to have T-shirts and board books for kids and toddlers celebrating LGBTQ month coming up in June Pride Month, would you be doing a boycott or not?
Well, I don't shop at Target a lot. I find myself in there every once in a while for something that I can only get there if that's the case. But I rarely go in at all. That said, this isn't new. They do this every year. Every May, Target comes out with a whole new collection because June is Pride Month and they do it every year. So this is not a new thing. They've been doing it, they did it at least 3 or 4 years ago. So it's not really a new thing. And I mean, I think Walmart has done.
But is it a defensible thing? But, is it a defensible thing? That's the question.
From a marketing standpoint, yeah, because they know there's a market for it. I don't know. I'm never going to shop in that section, and I'm not saying that I would ever consider. Like, I'm not saying I wouldn't boycott the entire store, but I haven't really thought about it because I just don't go in there.
I'm for boycotts. I think we ought to identify, companies that align with our values and, you know, and help and support them.
Yeah, because I don't want to sound like I'm saying you should be lazy about it, but I think it is a lot easier to find companies that align with your values and support them when you can than it is to track down every single company that is implementing some woke policy because there are too many of them. You're going to run out of things that you can do. You're going to run out of things that you can buy, and you're not going to be able to take care of your family at some point because there are so many that are willing to cave to this stuff. Yeah. So I think that the best, like you said, the best thing you can do is find the companies that align with your viewpoint and buy there when you can. And then you just limit your activity with the companies that don't, as much as possible.
All right.
And, sometimes that's, it's not possible. Sometimes you actually have to buy, the medicine from Walgreens or whatever. Not that Walgreens has done anything. I don't know.
Sound advice. We're out of time, Virginia. We got to run here. But thank you very much for your time. And I'm personally going to avoid Target. You can shop there. I'm going to avoid them. Okay. Thanks a lot, Virginia. Talk to you next time.
I don't go there to avoid it.
All right. All right, well, third hour of the Randy Tobler Show here on Newstalk STL 101.9 94.1. You know, you can stream us on, you can have your Alexa, you can use the app, you can stream us on NewstalkSTL.com, you can watch us on Facebook Live or on Rumble, and you can see Dr. Daniel Cusimano right there on the, I'm watching on Facebook Live as he's in studio today. You've heard me talk about Dr. Dan and the work he's done in my behalf for my dental work and at Advanced Dentistry of St. Charles. And I wanted you to get to know him a little bit better because he's got an impressive, impressive resume. How you doing, Dr. Dan? Thanks for being in the studio today.
Good morning, Randy. How are you?
I am doing well. And I got to get in and see you. I know. I've been moving, as you know. I got to get in, got to get that little cavity taken care of. I'll do it. I have to say, you did a very thorough exam, found the very earliest stages of some cavity, which I think would have been missed by, potentially elsewhere. And so it's, I want to talk about your precision and about your dedication to that, because I know your training, your practice, your style, as I've gotten to know you is, and this is a compliment, very OCD. You're very, very attentive to details. Very important in what dentists do, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of different ways to skin the cat, so to speak, but we have a very specific way that we like to do things that's patient-centric, and that's the best way to do things, in my opinion.
Yeah. Why dentistry? Why didn't you go into zoology or, engineering or,
scuba
diving? Why dentistry?
Well, I just figured that, back in the day when I was in college, we had a lot of opportunities to in the summer sessions to go see what kind of things that you wanted to do in terms of the medical field, dental field, do some shadowing experience. And I got a great opportunity when one of my family friends started a lab down at WashU, and I was able to do some research and some hands-on experience working on mice. And I found out that I was really good with my hands. And so it kind of started there, and really wanted to use those skills and develop relationships with people and families and be able to put all that together and make things work.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting field that's just evolved. I mean, the technology is amazing with all of the different materials that you use. I mean, a space age kind of stuff that wasn't there, 20, 30 years ago. And then also the diagnostic tools that you use as well. And I want to get into that a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about your training. I don't think most people know what dentists go through in terms of schooling. You mentioned undergrad, but then what happens after that and what can happen after that in terms of ongoing training outside the basic dental training?
Sure. So 4 years is required for dental school to get your degree. I chose to take an extra year, and I applied for a residency program. I just felt that I needed a little bit more experience. When you're in dental school, you get about 3 hours to do a procedure in the clinic, which is completely unrealistic in this day and age. Now we're doing procedures in 30 minutes to an hour. And so I just needed to pick up my speed, get my efficiency better. And so having this opportunity at the residency program was a tremendous help, because, which again, I think we're going to be getting into here soon, but I got a great experience and hands-on coaching with placing dental implants, which has been a game changer for our practice.
It's a game changer, I think, for many people's dental, health and experience. And I know my father, I was talking with my father-in-law. I told him I was going to be talking with you, and he's, I think he's 92 now, 93, and he got some implants, and it's so cool. So we'll talk about that. Now, you have a partner at Advanced Dentistry of St. Charles, and that's Dr. Megan Dwyer. Both of you are metro people, right? I mean, you're local folks.
That's right. She actually was born and raised in the St. Charles area. And funny story, she was, when she was a kid, patient at the practice that I purchased, and now she's a part of. So she's now come full circle, and it's a wonderful story. Yeah. She's able to tell everybody that.
Yeah, that's great. And then, of course, you have a full team of, you know, techs and hygienists and so forth. And like I say, I love going to the office because I always learn something I didn't know, and I get great, great care there. You've relaunched the website. Of course, Dr. Jay Olmos was the founder of the practice. You've taken it over from him and relaunched the website. It's a beautiful website at advanceddentistrynow.com. And I think we really ought to talk about some of the things you do there other than the general dentistry, which, of course, is so important. And that's really the foundation. You cover all ages, right? Kids to adults, right? The whole gambit, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We promote the whole family coming because a lot of dental issues and concerns can be genetically related. And so just being able to communicate from parent to son or daughter and just being able to have everybody under one roof is very important just for the communication aspects and just developing plans for everyone curtailed specifically to them.
All right. So I wanted to talk about a couple of things and specifically that catch my attention and that I think most people may see these commercials on the corporate sites and, you know, come in and get this done. Yeah, same day. Well, it's like a lot of smoke and mirrors. But there's an element to some of these things. It's so important to have that relationship and that very, you know, take a breath. I'm doing business with you directly. I'm not doing business with a strip mall dentist anymore. I don't mean me, but I mean people out there who are maybe lured to that. Dental implants. I would like to think that can, because I mean, you're talking about putting something into the bone of the jaw, right? And then putting a tooth on top of it. Explain what it is and what you do that's different that ensures precision and staying power and strength and quality and all that.
Sure. So the standard of care now to replace a missing tooth, whether you were born without it or you lost it because your tooth cracked or you had a root canal that failed, is to replace that with a dental implant. Now, back in the day, the dental implants, I don't know what these things are called, but remember those things that you would put in the grill to hold the charcoal, had the holes in it. That's what the implants that's what the implants used to look like. And the goal was to have those holes where the bone would start working its way in there and just interlocking the implant into place. And now things have advanced so much. The implants design, they have a tapered presentation to them so that they mimic a root. And so the goal is to mimic as much of the natural tooth as possible. Now, when implants first were introduced, the surgeon would do the procedure and place the implant wherever the available bone was. Now we can actually look at a patient and know exactly what kind of bone and the dimensions of that bone that's available to them so that we can be more predictable with our implant placement. And implant placement is not just about putting the implant in and then calling it a day. You also have to factor in where is this crown going to be, because the bite is extremely important, not only for the patient's everyday living when they're chewing and functioning, but also too from a perspective of just that implant doing well, making sure that the health around the bone and gum tissue is exceptional. And so placing that implant exactly where we want it to be in all of those schematics makes the predictability and the longevity of that implant much, much higher. And so what we do is we take, and this is another huge importance in the process, is we take a digital impression instead of taking the goop that we used to have to do. So we take a digital picture of that implant site, and then we take a cone beam x-ray, which is a three-dimensional scan that, when I was talking about looking at the quality of bone and the dimensions of bone, the CT scan gives us the perfect image of what the bone's going to look like, and we merge those two together, and so we can digitally put an implant on top of that bone and see where is it going to be and where that crown is going to be in the mouth. We put all those components together so that we can create a surgical guide, and that surgical guide is precision fit to that specific patient, and the implant procedure goes directly through that surgical guide so that we know that that implant was placed exactly where we planned it. Makes things 100% predictable and makes the procedure itself painless and very, very quick and efficient. A patient, we can get an implant in there in about 15 minutes and they're blown away by how quickly it goes.
Holy cow. So that's the, so that 3D thing is that the cone beam technology that's mentioned on the website?
Exactly.
AdvancedDentistryNow.com?
Yep, that's the standard of care for placing implants now. We used to only be able to use the x-ray called a panoramic x-ray, which shows all of your teeth on one picture, but that doesn't give you all of the dimensions that are available. And so that three-dimensional x-ray is crucial to this process.
So you mentioned not only, so this is, I'm thinking 3D, I'm thinking positional placement, all that, but you mentioned bone quality too, I think. And I guess I'm particularly attuned to that because I'm thinking about my patients over the years that have had severe bone problems, either metabolic bone disease or osteoporosis because of, you know, various habits or calcium or vitamin D deficiency. How do you factor either the eligibility or not for bone implant, for dental implants, with, you know, the whole body, the whole person? Or is that a clue? Is that necessary these days because of the placement and the materials you're using?
So bone quality can definitely be factored in on these CT scan imaging. Our lab that we work with has a tool that we can measure that. And so it gives me an idea about when I'm going into surgery, how that implant placement is going to go. Again, the more dense bone, the better. But if you have low density bone, you know, we may say that this is not a good solution for you. And we have other options to replace teeth. But again, you know, having all of these tools, especially when there's a lot of demand for dentistry, there's a lot of dentists out there. I just feel like, you know, we can give a patient the best, most precise result when we're talking about implants. And it's so predictable for everybody.
Yeah, I like that. It sounds like you actually, it's sort of like painting your room, you know, your house, or in my field, you know, surgical preparation or procedure. It's all in the prep, right? If you spend uber time evaluating the situation, planning, prepping the actual procedure, then I'm not saying it's a chip shot, but it makes it much more reliable and much more likely to be successful and work out for the long run. So that's great. It sounds like there's an awful lot of planning, technology, and experience that goes into this. And so it's fascinating. Now, people may say, oh, wow, that sounds fancy. Does my insurance cover that? Talk a little bit about dental insurance and some of the smoke and mirrors that is. A lot of people have insurance through their employers, you know, and what it covers, what it doesn't, and what you're doing to try to address financial concerns, which, of course, everyone has in every medical environment these days.
So dental insurance is actually what we like to call dental assistance. It's completely different than how medical insurance works. Dental insurance gives a patient like a false sense of security about being covered for any kind of dental need that's out there. If, you know, again, nobody's really reading the fine print of their dental insurance policies, but a lot of them, especially the smaller plans that are out there, do not have a lot of implant coverage and major coverage, which are, you know, crowns, bridges, implant crowns, any kind of root canal coverage, something like that. And they go into a situation feeling confident because they have dental insurance, and then they find out that they don't get any coverage, and they're shocked. And it's heartbreaking because they get frustrated and they don't go to the dentist again because they feel like they can't afford it, or they've been lied to, whatnot. So what we're trying to do is get patients, you know, again, if you're in a big corporation, you've got a nice policy and that's fantastic. But for patients that are small business owners, don't have the capabilities of getting a bigger corporate insurance policy, or just patients that don't have dental insurance, we offer a savings plan that acts like what your insurance plan would do, that we can cater specific treatment for your treatment plan and direct you based off of how you want to go, and give you the means both financially and time-wise to get things done where you feel like you're not pressed or you're forced to do something because your insurance company says this is what you're supposed to do. Because at the end of the day, we as dental providers want to give you the best care, and the insurance companies, all they care about is just getting their dollar. So we focus on you guys as patients to make sure that we can provide you a comprehensive plan, but we can stage it out. We can provide financing in terms of giving you however much months that you would need to pay off a certain procedure. Whatever the case would be, just by signing up for our savings plan, we can make things work for everybody.
All right. Well, I just got a text from one of our listeners. Dental insurance is smoke and mirrors. Tell that to my corporate clients who spend a combined billions on the oral health care of their employees, retirees, and their dependents. I don't think you said, that was my word, smoke and mirrors. What I meant is there's a lot of things that I think many people think are covered, but it really inadequately. I would call it under insurance. So it's not to say that people shouldn't have dental insurance, right, if they have access to it affordably. It's just that it may not cover all the things that folks want.
Yeah, exactly. It's they give you an allowance most of the time.
Yeah.
Sometimes they don't do that. But it's just something that, again, gives you this false sense that they're going to cover every single thing. And then if you are allowance driven, you don't get all your dental work done, and then you're kind of caught in a fire, so to speak. And it's challenging to get back out of it.
Well, and you're doing what I'm doing with Body of Health, our new direct primary care practice, where I don't deal with insurance. I mean, you do, and that's gracious of you, but I think more and more people want to be connected with their doctor directly. And just like you go and you buy your auto mechanic does the work for you. You don't go to buy auto mechanic insurance, and I think that more and more people are finding it works out better all the way around. You have a better relationship. It often saves you money in the long run because you can, without the middleman involved, you can save some bucks there. And, there's a place for insurance, but insurance should be for catastrophic stuff. Otherwise, you should deal directly with the provider. That's my philosophy.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything else you want to say before?
I was just going to add one more thing. Insurance looks at you just like a number. We treat you like a person, and everybody's needs are completely different, and that's what we try to do. We try to make sure that everybody is individualized and based off their needs, and we listen to them. We make sure that they're being heard.
Hey, next time we get together, we're out of time for this visit, but next time we get together, I'd like you to address some of the other things you do, like the aligners and especially that Botox and dermal fillers, some of the facial aesthetics thing you do, because there's a lot more services available. I'd recommend anyone who needs vent dental care now or in the future, give Dr. Dan and Dr. Megan Dwyer, his partner, a look at AdvancedDentistryNow.com. I use you guys, and I will continue. Thanks so much, Dr. Dan. Thanks for being with me. You're welcome to hang out as we move forward and we talk with someone who thinks that Michelle Obama may be the person for the 24 Democrat Party. I don't know. Dr. Dan, you may want to hang out in the studio. There may be some fireworks when we talk to our next guest. Thanks for being with me, buddy.
Appreciate it. Randy. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with me all morning, this morning, and every Saturday morning from 6 to 9. Don't forget, coming up right after this, On the Money with Bob Stockdale and Eric Robert. You won't want to miss that. There's so much going on in our economy. We didn't even get to talk about the debt ceiling talks and how they broke down. Then they reconvened last evening. Who's going to blink first in this game of chicken? Who knows? Really looking forward to this conversation with my guest now, Mr. Joel Gilbert. And he's the author of Michelle Obama 2024, Her Real Life Story and Plan for Power, and director of the documentary Michelle Obama 2024. Joel, welcome to the Randy Tobler Show.
Okay, thank you. Great to be here.
You know what? When I saw the work you're doing and the work you've done concerning Michelle Obama, it really resonated, because I believe that there has been and it must be developing. And I have nothing else other than a tinfoil hat to say this, and just my synthesis of the way the landscape's developing in the Democrat Party. I think that Michelle Obama's had her eyes on the presidency for quite a while. And when I saw that you're saying that that's what's going to happen, what do you base that on, Joel?
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence for that. I mean, first of all, the Democrats have pretty much set up the field for Michelle to be the nominee. They moved the first primary out of Iowa, where instead of campaigning in 100 counties, to South Carolina, which Michelle Obama claims as a adopted home state because her grandparents are from South Carolina, and 50% of the primary electorate are African American there. And then they put the DNC, Democrat Convention, is in Chicago, the hometown of Michelle Obama. So it's clearly set up for her. And in the meantime, I did a lot of research and went to Chicago and talked to her friends and family, her mother, her high school and elementary school classmates, everybody she knew. And I found out a lot about her real life history that I show in the film. But certainly politically in the last few years, I note that Michelle has been pretty much following the exact same formula that Barack did to become president. Barack had a voter registration organization in Chicago called Project Vote before he ran for president. Michelle's started something called When We All Vote for the last 4 years. She's been running around the country registering people to vote, very well funded by the Soros gang. Barack was the keynote speaker for John Kerry in 2004 at the Democrat convention. He introduced John Kerry. That's the slot they give to the person they think will be the nominee pretty much at the next convention. Sure enough, Michelle was the keynote speaker for Joe Biden, introduced him at the 2020 convention. And lastly, Barack based his candidacy on his personal story. He wrote his book, autobiography, Dreams from My Father. Michelle did the same thing. She wrote an autobiography called Becoming. And she just wrote another autobiography called The Light We Carry. So I think she's positioned herself exactly politically with a very high profile to be in the game politically, and the Democrat Party has set it up for her.
Wow, I wasn't aware of all of those eerie similarities. Do you have any evidence? Well, has Barack Obama played any cards in his, in his either public speeches or written documents that would suggest that he's, part and parcel of this, which certainly he would be. But I mean, has he given any clues in his communications?
I think the plan is for Barack Obama to lay in the background. Michelle doesn't want to be seen as someone who's just running for office because her husband was president. She's kind of her own person. She has her own following. She's had 15 years of all positive publicity, hundreds of magazine covers, hundreds of talk shows. She's written books. She's been an executive in Chicago. So she's pretty much the most popular person in the United States, if not the whole planet. And I think the plan is for Michelle to kind of stay out there as her own person and Barack to lay in the background. I don't think he's really needed, because if Michelle is really more popular than Barack was, she's a better politician than Barack ever was, she's a better speaker, and she comes across more authentic than Barack.
Every politician, no matter how popular, and by the way, what are her popularity numbers? I haven't really been following that. Do we have any latest ticker on that?
Well, she's just the most popular person in the country. I mean, she's been working the core constituent groups of women and minorities for years, developing those audiences, her books in particular. So if you ask any random person on the street or look for any poll online, she is the most popular female in America.
Yeah. And it cuts across racial lines, too.
Sure. I mean, white women especially. I mean, Michelle really has captured that audience of Oprah Winfrey, audience, TV show audience, as well as minorities. She's been working it for many years, and that's what her core appeal is. Now, her biggest vulnerability, really, ironically, is the same as Barack. When Barack ran for president, white people thought he was black, and they thought, oh, that's great, let's have a black president. They supported him, but black people didn't buy in. They thought that, well, this guy's biracial, he's from Hawaii, he went to Harvard, he's not one of us, and they did not support him for a long time. Michelle actually has the same problem, because, as I chronicle in my book and film, She had no experiences with the black community growing up. She spent her childhood in fear of black people. She talks about this openly. They would make fun of her for acting white and talking white. She even talks about getting in a fist fight with a girl who called her an Oreo, meaning you're black on the outside, but you're really a white girl on the inside. So for her education, Michelle's parents avoided all-black elementary school and sent her to a gifted school. For high school, instead of going to an all-black high school one block from her house, which was actually a good school, they sent her an hour and a half away to a gifted school. So Michelle always ran away from the black community, and she has nothing in common with black people, no experiences with them. She then went to Princeton and Harvard, of course, and then I chronicle her jobs in Chicago were exploiting the black community. She worked for the mayor of Chicago as assistant planning commissioner, and her job was to knock down the projects at Cabrini Green. The Democrat donor developers like Tony Resco wanted the land where the projects were located near downtown. So Michelle destroyed the projects and made 20,000 black people homeless and told them this is going to be good for you if we take away your homes. Then the University of Chicago Medical Center hired Michelle for $300,000 a year to deny access to good health care to the black Southside community. If they showed up at the emergency room, Michelle would put you in a van and dump you at some crappy clinic. So Michelle made a lot of money from white liberals to deal with their problems with black people. They couldn't hire a white person to take away their health care and say, it's going to be good for you if we take away your health care. But Michelle had her jobs were exploiting the black community and abusing them. So Michelle's trying very hard to pretend to be one of these ordinary black folks that she spent her life exploiting. And she does that by making up these fake racial stories, how she was held back in life because of her skin color and she suffered racial, slights. One of her stories she's been telling for years, she claimed that her high school counselor at her exclusive high school racially profiled her regarding her application to Princeton University. She said, you're black, maybe you're stretching going to Princeton. And I found out the high school counselor was a church-going black woman, so that's not true. Michelle chronically tries to manipulate the black community with these fake stories.
Yeah. So it's fair to say, I guess, that I didn't know all of that background. I can't wait to read. I'm going to get into this. I hope everyone picks up a copy of Michelle Obama 2024, her real life story and plan for power, and takes a look at your documentary, Michelle Obama 2024. It sounds to me like she's the definition of white privilege. She just doesn't have the white melanin. you know what I mean?
And look, that's true. Michelle, her biggest problem is she really is a white girl at heart. Barack even said when he met her, the family was like Leave It to Beaver. And he said Michelle reminded him of his, old white grandmother. And so that's her problem is she has nothing in common with black people. She had no black friends. She doesn't have any black friends now except for a few that she actually defines. She always says, I have this friend and she has light skin. She always talks about if she has a black friend, they have to have light skin. She married a biracial man. So that's Michelle's real vulnerability. And that's why she chronically tries to manipulate black voters with these phony stories that she suffered from racial discrimination. Michelle was in exclusive schools. She went to Paris when she was in high school with her French club. How many discriminated kids go to Paris with their French club in high school? She was in a dance class for 10 years. She performed at the Chicago Theater at the International Hilton Hotel. Very privileged kid from a political family. Her father was a precinct captain working for the Democrat Party machine. She grew up in Jesse Jackson's house partially because she was best friends with his daughter Santita when Jackson was running for president. So she's always been an elitist. And by the way, you can see the movie if you can live stream it on salemnow.com, and then the book or DVD are on amazon.com.
Oh man, I can't wait to take it all in. I guess that there's an awful lot there then for, should she become the nominee, for her opponent to exploit in terms of doubling her lifestyle, she and Barack, doubling down on the truth of her upbringing and her past, her very privileged past. And by the way, I don't think I hear you saying that anyone begrudges anyone a nice upbringing with the opportunities she's had, but it's awfully it's awfully hypocritical and deceitful to try to paint it some other way for political gain. That's your beef, right? It's not the lifestyle itself.
Look, Michelle is, you know, she experienced the American dream. I mean, she got out of, you know, she avoided going to school with black people and went to exclusive schools, went to Princeton and Harvard, got a job at a great law firm and worked for the mayor. I mean, it's the true American dream, what she's achieved, but she doesn't tell the truth about that. She claims that, oh, I just suffered and was held back in life to manipulate black voters. But, for a Republican to deal with her as a candidate, they're going to have the courage to do it, because the media loves to use race as a weapon against Republicans. But the things they need to do, and even now, is say things like, Michelle, are you going to apologize for what you did to the black community in Chicago? Michelle, how much money did you make off the University of Chicago to deny access to health care to black people? These are the kind of things to open up a discussion to show the truth about what Michelle really did in her professional career and how hypocritical she is from that aspect, and everything from the fact that they bought a $14 million home on the beach in Martha's Vineyard. I mean, that's the ultimate white liberal elite experience, is to go live there with those people on Martha's Vineyard. And also that she must believe climate change is a hoax. Why would you buy a mansion right on the beach?
Yeah. And of course, all those Martha Vineyard bleeding heart liberals, they love when those immigrants land on their doorstep, right? Not.
Yeah, so that just shows who the Obamas really are.
There's another I think thing that she may have to, well, she would have a problem with politically, and that is when she made that statement, for the first time in my adult life, I'm really proud of my country, not just because Barack is doing well, but I think people are hungry for change. That really got the goat of so many people, not even on the right, but in the middle too. It's like, wait a minute, because there were murmurs that she had a pretty decent upbringing. I think in general people maybe have forgotten, they don't know all the details, which your book and your documentary chronicle, but they knew she was not a suffering ghetto child, and to sort of then disdain the country that had provided her, you know, where she was at.
Yeah,
she go about fighting back on that?
Look, Michelle loves to say that she's from the, I'm a South Side girl. I grew up in the South Side of Chicago. No, she didn't. She grew up in South Shore, which is on Lake Michigan, very exclusive middle class area. It's where Jesse Jackson lives as well. He never said he's from the South Side of Chicago. So she tries to create this romantic notion of overcoming all these obstacles in life. But when she said back in 2008, you might remember, she actually was on the road giving speeches to massive audiences night after night, supporting Barack's candidacy in 2008. And she said a lot of nasty things. I mean, it was talking about how Americans all live in fear of each other and we're all fearful. She got that from Bernadine Dorn, that whole politics of fear. Bernadine Dorn was the head of the Weather Underground terrorist group in the 60s. Michelle actually worked with Bernadine Dorn at the Sidley and Austin law firm for a couple of years. And Michelle and Barack would go to dinner at the home of Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers for years in the 90s. So I make the case Michelle was radicalized by Bernadine Dorn, by these domestic terrorists. But Michelle was so nasty in those speeches. And then she said, well, for the first time in my life, I'm proud of my country because Barack won a primary. She actually said a lot worse things than that. But that's what got the attention of the media. And that's when the campaign came to her and said, look, now they're paying attention to what you're saying. We need you to, everyone's going to hate you and maybe Barack's going to lose because of you. So she decided to take a step back and she said, oh, I hate politics and I just want to be the mom in chief. So she took that step back instead of being this angry political candidate who was the co-candidate at the time. She talked about, oh, Barack and I, our campaign and what we're going to do in the White House. It was all a co-candidacy. She took a step back, and she's maintained that for years, that she doesn't like politics and she just wants to, you know, help people and do service. But that's just a ruse for someone who's very political and has her own political agenda.
Now, it's going to be fascinating to see how it all unfolds. And I think you are spot on. And now you have all of that deep dive into the details of Michelle Obama's life on your book. And that's available at Amazon, right? That's called
Amazon.com for the book or the DVD. Yeah. SalemNow.com, you can actually live stream the movie.
Sounds
and
good.
Get the DVD as well.
I'm surprised that the Amazon hasn't canceled you. I mean, they did that on the Clarence Thomas documentary, you know, that you couldn't get that for a while. So
yeah, I've done okay with Amazon. They haven't canceled me. I got canceled before off of Vimeo for my film called The Trayvon Hoax. They canceled it. So it's a tough environment digitally if you oppose the Democrat agenda.
Yeah. Well, Joel Gilbert, thanks for this great research work. And then, of course, putting it all in a digestible fashion for the folks that need to know, because I think she's going to be a player. I really do. And I agree with you totally. And thank you for being with me. Really appreciate it. I can't wait to view the documentary and read the book. And I hope everyone accesses it. Thanks for your hard work and for being
with
me.
Thanks so much. Okay.
All right. Joel Gilbert. And that's, I mean, this is something to ponder. What do you guys think? 314-912-1019. I don't think this is a crazy notion. I think she is going to make a run for the nomination. Maybe she'll be a convention nominee if it turns out that there is wide disagreement on whether Biden has the stuff. And I mean, we're really Gavin Newsom. Are you kidding me? I think she's going to be the one that just emerges as, wow, look at me. I'm the popular one. I'm the consensus candidate. Let's all get together, have a big hug, and let's have Barack Obama version 2.0 under the guise of Michelle. That's what I'm thinking. Let me know what you think as we come back here.